And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy!
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds!
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The race is on. Testing is now one-third over after day two in Barcelona, and it was Mercedes that proved to be the talk of the town with its trick steering system. And with another day of running, have we inched closer to a view of the real competitive order? I'm Ed Straw, and joining me to make sense of it all are Gary Anderson and Mark Hughes. Gary, I'm sure we'll get onto your detailed number crunching in a bit, but do you feel like you've taken a step forward in your understanding today?
No, I suppose is the quickest way of putting it. I mean, all we can do is look at what's happening and seeing the cars running. Today, we had our very first red flag right at the end of the day. And what normally happens with that is that people want to try and do a fuel run-out test to see the fuel system all works properly. It was just after Kimi Räikkönen had done his fastest lap of the day on the very soft tyre. And two laps later or something, I think he ran out of fuel. So I think you know, well, he stopped anyway, whether he ran out of fuel or not, I'm not quite sure. But it's, you know, you do do that during testing, that's what it's for. And if you've got any brain at all, you'll do it either just before lunchtime or just before the evening, because it means the track gets red flagged and everybody stops. But in general, looking at where we've got to, there's a bit of a variation in tyres. And, you know, I have no idea of the fuel loads. I would say, you know, the professional teams don't normally run very light on fuel, because, you know, they know they want to do their work. So 50, 60 kilograms of fuel, whatever they're doing, runs. As you come down through the range of teams, I think you might come down to 30 kilograms or something like that. So, you know, you're not going to get vast differences in it. So the fuel load, anything we would do, as I did it last night on my report for the first day, just to show the amount of fuel that it would have taken to have made a difference to last year's times. That could be, again, happening, but anything we do would be guessing. All I've done for today's running is taken yesterday's tyres that were used for their fastest lap for each team, today's tyres that was used for the fastest lap, and I've calculated that to suit everybody running on the medium tyre, which is the C3, which is the majority of cars have run on that, so it's the least calculations required, so the, you know, the least fudge factors, I suppose you might call it. What we're seeing is Mercedes are the fastest. Racing Point are next, and they're 0.76 of a percent slower. I turn everything into percentages because that means we can compare performance around Barcelona to Monaco or Melbourne or wherever. So I turn everything into a percentage. Red Bull next at 0.87 of a percent slower. Renault, 1% slower than Mercedes. Toro Rosso, 1.1% slower than Mercedes. McLaren, 1.5% slower, Williams 1.8, Alfa Romeo 1.9, Haas 2.2, and Ferrari 2.2. Now, you know, we know Ferrari aren't going to be down there in the end, and they're definitely doing their testing differently this year, but that's where they are at the minute. That's all we can do is look at their lap times. You know, the difference in Mercedes's performance to Ferrari's performance is about 50 kilograms of fuel. But we know that Mercedes aren't running about too light. So if Ferrari drain out 50 kilograms and do the same lap time as Mercedes, Mercedes will drain out, you know, 40 and do more or less the same. So Ferrari do look as though they're in a little bit of trouble.
What do you reckon, Mark Hughes?
Yeah, I would concur that Ferrari don't look in great shape, even though it's nowhere near as bad as it looks on the numbers. Just from observation on track, it doesn't look a great car at the moment. Doesn't look great in low speed, especially. Hasn't got a front end. It's well down on straight line speeds, although they say they're running in low power mode. But yeah, okay. But it's a long way down. It's over 20 kilometers down to the fastest. That 0.7% gap between Mercedes and Racing Point, Gary, that's, I guess, what, about half a second on a Barcelona lap.
It's 20 kilograms of fuel. Really,
yeah, so it's somewhere in the ballpark. It's not, even if we say they were maybe running 20 kilos lighter than Merck, they're still less than a second away, aren't they? On what we've seen so far. So that does sort of tally that is a very good car, that new Racing Point.
I think new Racing Point, it does everything quite well. I mean, again, you're talking maybe, you know, 20 kilograms maybe of difference. Mercedes were out today doing long runs and they were doing, you know, 1 minute 20s. So they lost like 3 seconds with extra fuel in the car. So I would imagine during their runs that they did this, they would be in the ballpark of 50 kilograms, half tanks type thing. Because you don't want to over abuse the tyres by having it full all the time. You don't want to under abuse the tyres by having it low of fuel. So you have to do your homework correctly. And the best homework is to run between 60 and 50 kilograms or something like that, 65 to 55. And I'm sure that's what the top teams would do. So I think Racing Point are
talking to Sergio Perez tonight at the end, he was sort of playing it down, saying it's very early days, we've got a lot of work to do yet. But you could tell just by the way he was expressing himself, he was quite excited by what he's got under him. And he's saying the other thing is that the system that they've got in place now, that they've got the car ready early, and it's what they've got here is they know is the basis for what they're taking to Melbourne, whereas previously they had just the most basic and with a lot of add-ons to come in Melbourne that they didn't know, you know, whether they would, how they would work. So he's a very happy bunny. It's attracted a lot of attention for its visual similarity to the Mercedes, but I'm more excited by the fact that it's looking very competitive.
It's what we expect from that team in a way, though, isn't it? It's kind of back to normal for a team that has excelled in the midfield pack and they've got more investment. So after a couple of really hard years, it's kind of the natural order that it would be a serious midfield threat, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. You know, it should be a serious midfield threat, and I think it's actually a little bit better. As I say, obviously it is a bit of a Mercedes clone or whatever you like to call it, but they're genuinely standing up and saying, well, why not? And I agree with them, why not? Mm-hmm. You know, 6 years of winning the world championships, both constructors and drivers from Mercedes, you'd be a fool to turn a blind eye to what they did. So, you know, we've got thousands and thousands of photographers are hanging around Formula One practices, tests and races. You know, you can snap those cars, you know, every which angle and take it back and you know, you can read the pictures and then you can get more pictures taken. So I'm sure that's the route they took, just get a few good snappers taking pictures and copy it. But Red Bull's the interesting one for me because, you know, we look at sandbagging here. If anybody's sandbagging, I think Red Bull are the ones that are sandbagging because I went down out the track today and I was amazed. It was Albon driving, but I was amazed at the speed of the car through turn 1, 2, and 3.
One, two, and three, I concur.
Absolutely.
So yesterday it looked fantastic, that car through.
I was timing him on my watch, my lap time, and he never completed the lap. But the speed he was going at, relative to a few others that were actually doing longer runs, I agree, was incredible.
Yeah.
And it took me by surprise because I did do a comment back to Ed to say that, to use an old Fernando Alonso comment, the rest of these cars look like GP2s, because that's what it looked like. I was amazed, and I was amazed that the lap time didn't come, so maybe they're just doing bits of the track and not so fast in other bits, whatever, I don't know. But
it's incredibly aggressive and direction change there, isn't it? He just throws the lock on and it just responds instantly. It looks fantastic. But going back, I guess, a little bit to what we were saying yesterday, maybe it's just in the speed ranges because he was having difficulty further on than the lap around the slope. It's, so, yeah, that's... Yeah, there's you can see. Sometimes you can just see there's a lot more to come there in terms of performance. So,
if you go further down, Renault, AlphaTauri, McLaren, Williams not so much, but Alfa Romeo, Haas and Ferrari, to be honest, they've got less front end. You know, if anything gives up, the car will start to understeer about through turn three, gets them out in the marbles. Williams, I was quite impressed with. It was driving on a decent line. Mm-hmm. It probably just doesn't have the grip.
Yep.
But it wasn't a bad car by any means. Yep. Not like last year's car, where it was a white knuckle job all the time. So I think done a good job there.
Just having a look at the speed trap times, the peak one. Obviously, you mentioned Ferrari sort of being 20 kilometres an hour off, which they were generally. The absolute peak times, the closest they got, Vettel was clocked at 310.5. The fastest was Bottas at 324.3. So even the best possible gap was 14-odd kmh, but the gap generally was big. Fuel plays a part in that. Drag levels play a part in that. Programs play a part in that. But obviously, we have seen the change in the engine regulations this year. There's the second fuel flow sensor, which is the same fuel flow sensor, but it's a black box to the
you don't know what it's gonna
the teams cannot read it, only the FIA can. If there were to be any shenanigans going on, the idea being you can't game it. So how should we view what's going on with Ferrari? Because there were all these accusations and suggestions last year.
I think until we see a representative performance from them, because what we've seen so far is definitely not a representative performance. The way they're running their program is very different. So until we've seen a representative performance from that car around here, which, whenever we see that, I don't think we can...
On the speed, Zed, where's the other two Ferrari engined?
Well, actually, Roman Grosjean in the Haas, he's third. So Bottas was fastest, 324.3. And in fact, actually, Kimi Raikkonen was 323.9 in second place. I missed him. So in the Alpha, which that was on a fairly low fuel. Yeah, and then Grosjean, 318.8. So the customer teams are running quicker. And that's the big question with Ferrari, isn't it? Because they are running a program that means, we're not sitting here saying they're seconds off the base. They clearly aren't.
Yeah.
But it just creates this big question mark.
There was a 327 yesterday. There was a 327 from Red Bull and a 329 from McLaren. But that was yesterday.
Yeah, there will be a tow and the use of the DRS and stuff. But the three Ferrari teams at the minute are the three slowest from my calculations. Alfa Romeo, then Haas, and then Ferrari. The Ferrari engine team. So, Ferrari publicly said they were going to go for downforce and that will create drag. So we can understand the fact they're a bit slower on the straight if they have got that downforce. The other two teams, you'd say, they're probably lacking in downforce. And hence they probably don't have as much drag as well. I'm not saying their cars are more efficient than the Ferrari, but once the numbers start climbing and downforce, you have to compromise a bit on the drag. So the fact that three of them are the slowest three teams, and the two customer teams are reasonably quick, and the worst Ferrari isn't sort of. I think there's some understanding there, but Ferrari for sure they need to show their hand sometime. You can't if they detune the engine and stuff, they're not getting any testing here that will push the engine to its limits. You need to, at some point in time, run everything to its limit to make sure that when you get to Melbourne, you don't have a hiccup coming. So we'll wait and see as time goes by.
Well, we should expect to see ever more information tomorrow. It's the final day of the first test, only the third day of testing overall. Of course, only 6 days in total. So hopefully by tomorrow, we'll get a further narrowing of the data and get an idea for people. Loads of people have been doing, and sounds like Lando Norris and the McLaren was doing lots of longer runs, fairly heavy fuel. We saw some plenty of long running from the Mercedes over the 2 days. So it's it's all kind of narrowing, isn't it? And zeroing in. So I mean, tomorrow, Gary, what do you expect to see? If this was you setting your run program, assuming as everyone pretty much has, you've had two relatively smooth days, you've done the mileage. What would you be saying to your guys? Right, we're going to go in and then 9 o'clock, pit lane opens. What are we going to do?
Well, I think, if you've done mileage and you're happy that the car is working as you sort of predicted before you came to this test, then your development path is sort of fairly well underway to suit the car you've got. You want to recognize any problems you've got, but considering that they might not be there, at some point in time tomorrow, I would have to say that it would be worth, winding the engine up and dropping the fuel to, not a low fuel, 20 kilograms, 25 kilograms or something, and just going out and seeing that the car responds to that weight change. So if you've got 50 kilograms in the car, you take 30 of it out, and turn the engine up, you should probably go knocking on the door of a couple of seconds faster. So by tomorrow night, we can look at, you know, who they are. The average times is one thing, but the actual peak time is another thing. And, you know, to do it, you have to wring the car's neck. And you can see that in the car. What I saw the Red Bull today around turn one, two, and three was, there wasn't much left there. It was quick. It was very, very quick.
Well, we'll have a brief break now. We'll be back after this to talk about Mercedes steering and a few other tech points on the cars. Well, let's get down to the really big talking point of the day, which is the Mercedes steering trick, as we call it. Trick as in cleverness rather than suggesting it's something that's illegal, although some have suggested it. It may be the DAS, the DAS steering system. Gary Anderson, can you give us the short summary, but the understandable medium length summary of the whole thing?
What are you saying to me? I talk too much. Yeah, medium thing is the problem basically is overheating the inside shoulder of the front tire, because with toe out on the car and the camber on the car, the tire scrubs going down the straight, and also you basically that overheats the tire and you end up with potential blisters on the inside shoulder, or as you can see many times on TV, the rubber hanging off the side of it because you're just scrubbing that little bit of tire about 5 centimeters wide all the time, and it's also slowing the car down on the straights. So you have to find solutions to that. Solution is either take the toe out of the car, but you don't want to do that because it makes the car too pointy in at the corner. Too pointy means the rear of the car is very nervous. You need to have the toe out to sort of quieten down the front of the car so it doesn't turn so quickly, to allow the rear to pick up the grip, which is what gives the driver the confidence. Or you adjust the camber, which you don't want to do because then the tire tucks under in the fast corners with the lateral forces. So basically, you want to keep the camber the maximum that Pirelli allow you to run, and you want to keep the toe out, so you have to find some other solution to doing that. You can pump up tire pressures, that reduces a little bit, but that loses grip. So what Mercedes have come up with is a very clever system that basically the driver going down the straight has X, he's got the steering wheel towards him as such. When he gets to the braking point, he pushes the steering wheel forward. It could be, you know, 3 centimetres, 4 or 5 centimetres he moves it, you know, a reasonable amount. And basically that puts the toe out on the car. The way the linkage works, there's a video on YouTube which you can watch of, you know, a fairly simple little model we built. So basically, he's got the toe out in the corner, and when he comes off the corner onto a straight, he can pull the steering wheel towards him, and the toe out reduces to straight ahead or maybe a little bit of toe in. So it does two jobs at once. It's all mechanically linked, as far as I know, and that's what you have to do to be legal. The linkage system we came up with today was, you know, took 15 minutes to do it, which is not a really big job to do. It can be done. So yes, will it be an advantage? We won't know around here. They're just learning to use it around here. It'll be other races and tire degradation where they'll be trying to make it work, you know, as a performance tool.
And Mark, this is an interesting area because for the top teams, the whole sort of front suspension, adjust the geometry dynamically with steering lock. This is a huge area of development over the past few years, and it's actually, I think, quite a big part of the advantage those big three teams have got. And this is just another level, isn't it, that Mercedes has gone to try out this system.
Yeah, I like that it's a clever idea, but a simple one. So you can grasp what it's about, you know, really quite easily, but yet nobody thought of it until now.
Push it that way, it does that. And you can see the steering wheel.
And watching
well.
The onboard with Lewis, it didn't look like it was going to be something that would take any getting used to. You just be, I would imagine, second nature very, very quickly. So, yeah, it's, I guess, how much performance will it bring will determine whether teams, you know, go wholesale for it, but I would imagine it's relatively easy to look at and assess the feasibility of doing it and trying it out. So, yeah, interesting.
Yeah, it would be a new steering rack. Basically, obviously, pushing the steering wheel forward when you hit the brake pedal isn't that difficult because these things brake at 5 or 6 G. So, you know, everything wants to go that way anyway. And whenever you're accelerating, they accelerate pretty rapidly as well. So everything wants to come back. So, you know, everything's working in your favor as far as the driver's concerned. There's no big effort level suddenly required to do it. Do you have to do it precisely? I think it would sort of do it itself if you let go of the steering wheel. Most of that would happen anyway, just because of the forces. So they would probably have a what we call a little detent, a little ball and a spring, so that it's got two positions, click, click. You know, it's either forward or it's backward. So, you know, yeah, I think pretty easy to do. It would mean a new steering rack. A steering rack on these cars are by no means simple. They're a very complicated hydraulically assisted steering rack, but it would mean a new steering rack and a new mechanism inside it. But not that difficult, as I said to someone else earlier, if you really believed that it was the big benefit and wanted to do it, you'd probably have it on for the first race in Europe. The big thing will be tyre degradation. Can they get an extra lap out of it? Can they get an extra two laps on a stint, three laps on a stint? I wouldn't be surprised if you're looking at that type of improvement, you know, two, three laps improvement on the tyre degradation. If you can look after the rear tyres, now, again, Mercedes has done a lot of work on the rear suspension, which we haven't really seen in detail because it's been covered in the cars, but I'm going to have a very good snoop tomorrow. I think that's my mission, to try and see what they've done on that. But I think they've also worked very hard there to help the rear tyre degradation.
Yeah, there's interest innovation going on everywhere. I mean, that was very visual because we saw the onboard camera, but the Red Bull's got an interesting front suspension. Last year, if you remember, they introduced the multi-link on the front suspension. And initially, it looked as though this didn't have multi-link when you look at it from above, but apparently it is still multi-link, but it is done from underneath. And it's apparently an exquisite bit of work that they're delighted with. Everything is so regulated, it's amazing how much innovation can still come out. We're seeing two completely different areas of innovation just on the top two cars. It's fantastic.
That's the amazing thing. And in fact, Gary, you did a piece on the race.com website, just looking at the rear end of the top three cars and just everything, you know, the wastegate outlet positions, wishbone angles, diffuser. There's differences in all of them. And people say all the cars look the same. But actually, even to the untrained eye, you can sit there and you can look at it and you can see points of difference. You can spot the difference even if you don't understand what they mean. So this is... It just shows there's a real, real battle waging between those big three teams still.
Yeah, there is a big battle, and the regulations are stable from 2019 to 2020. So it's all about dotting the I's and crossing the T's all around the car. It's not as though you're like 2021 committed to having to design a complete new package. So the teams, or the size they are, the big teams like Red Bull and Mercedes, they can focus a lot on small detail, and I would say that's what we're seeing is just lots and lots of small detail that normally you just wouldn't have the time or energy to do because you've got so much to do because of a regulation change. So it's those little bits, you know, they're all small, but they all add up somewhere along the line. And at the end of the day, you get a lump sum of performance gain. And so, you know, we have to see how it'll work. I think it looked pretty good to me. My understanding of it and my thinking about why it's there and stuff, I think it's pretty valid. So I believe that there will be a performance advantage. 90% of it, or 99% of it, will probably come in races. There will be a little bit of a speed advantage in qualifying to use it down the straights. Because if you can imagine, whenever the tyres are new, we always see, put new tyres on the car goes slower down the straight than it does on older tyres. So the grip of the tyre being pushed down the straight, of the front tyres scrubbing on a new tyre, does affect the speed quite dramatically. So there will be a small advantage in qualifying, but I think a big advantage will come in the race.
And just digressing a little bit, there's a story that's just gone live on our website on therace.com by Scott Mitchell about the fact Red Bull had to change their Honda engine because, and this shows you the scale of it, they found something on the dyno in Japan that concerned them a bit about a certain part, a precautionary change. But that made them change the engine because obviously something showed up. It just got to show it's not just about what's going on here. It's not just about what's going on in the UK at the factory. It's what's going on in Japan. Just the sort of 360-degree-ness, for want of a better phrase, of the whole thing. The amount of data that's going through for this testing is absolutely phenomenal. And although people complain about it, and we all like the idea of kind of a small racing team all sort of hands-on, everything sort of mechanically linked together, it's all in the here and now. It is worth just once in a while stepping back and just going how astonishing it is that this is all going on at the same time. That's what the hundreds of millions of pounds buys you.
Well, if you know, just sort of relating it to aircrafts, I mean, if you ever go to the Boeing factory or any of these aircraft manufacturers, you'll see planes sitting there on a multi-hydraulic rig that basically are deflecting everything physically possible, accelerated to the maximum loads or deflection that they witness in reality in the flight. So, you know, it might take a 747, you know, 5 years to go through all this scenario of loads and deflections of wings and stuff. But at the Boeing factory, they're doing that in 5 months. So they can pick up cracks in surfaces or skins or whatever earlier and get repairs done for it, all that stuff. So they're way, way ahead of the game. And that's the same as happening in Formula One. You know, people about factories are taking wishbones and front wings and rear wings and engines and gearboxes and, you know, more or less, you know, testing them to destruction or close to destruction. So if somebody here at the factory sees, you know, a load over a curb that they've created and, you know, suddenly it's 10% more than the load that they've tested all the suspension to, that'll go back to the factory and they'll be putting those components that suffered that load onto the rig or the same components and running 10% higher and seeing if it's okay. And Honda are doing exactly the same with engines. There's probably two or three of them on dynos going for mileages of, you know, equivalent to 6,000-7,000 kilometers. So you've got to be ahead of the game. And that's what this is all about, just being ahead of the game.
It's a big thing, isn't it? The whole, all this simulation work. In fact, Mark, as you were talking earlier about the Alfa Romeo simulator situation, they're Johnny come lately, should we say, to the simulator revolution, which pretty much was starting two decades ago now, wasn't it? It was McLaren that really started to pioneer it, the driver in loop simulator I'm talking about here, where you have the driver involved. And the fact that's a genuine disadvantage for Alfa Romeo, and it's one that's going to take a while, very long lead time to get sorted, just tells you how important all of these things are to making it work.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably even a negative initially while you're devoting resource to understanding it and getting it to work. And they're saying, you know, conservative estimate, maybe 18 months before it's a regular tool that we can use every day and know that it's helping us. So it's, you know, but that level of excellence and devotion, it goes right through. If you just watch a routine pit stop, or there was a Red Bull came in earlier on and they needed a part change, and you just watch how synchronized everyone is. And in a normal world, in a normal paid job, to get a bunch of people that motivated to be at that level of excellence all the time as normal, it's impossible to conceive you could do it. And yet it's just normal in Formula One and racing, isn't it?
But just to fill in my little story here of the past, 1990, the Jordan 191, we're talking about wings, loading them up and testing them and stuff, you know, like they do now on rigs, front and rear wings and whatever. And our way of doing it was to go down the builder's yard, buy some 25 kilogram bags of sand and mount the front wing and the nose onto a rig and stick bags of sand on it to the loads that we thought the wing would go through, and thought was the right word, measuring the deflection of it and listen for noises, and the same with the rear wing. But, you know, it worked, so that's all you had at the time. So what do you do? It's better to do that than do nothing. So, times have moved on a lot.
It's funny, isn't it? Because that sounds crude, but it's still just a simulator. It's just a lower res simulation, really, isn't it? So actually what you were doing then and what's happening now, it's the same thing, just on a very different level of resource.
It's the same thought process, the same philosophy. It's just different tools.
Yeah, it's exactly the same. The old thing, if you put the, you can stick the sort of tufts all over the car and drive it through the air, photograph it, that's your kind of wind tunnel. The world is your wind tunnel, shall we say. That used to be an old method.
One of the things, we had a problem. If we got time for this other story, we had a problem with the Jaguar I designed for 2000.
Was that the one that was fighting for the championship?
That was the one that the drivers thought would fight for the championship, but it wasn't.
Always the driver's fault.
No, not really. I mean, we tested the car initially and the car was good. Both Johnny and Eddie thought that, Johnny Herbert and Eddie Jordan and Eddie Irvine thought the car was pretty good. And that was around Barcelona here. And, we were on song. First race, there was a few things happened that shouldn't have happened because Cosworth did some stuff to the... We basically oiled the gearbox with the excess oil from the engine rather than having separate pumps and stuff on to save weight. And there was a filter on the way back, and Cosworth decided to be clever and put in a 3-micron filter instead of a 20-micron filter. So basically, they will never come out of the gearbox, and we lost a couple of gearboxes with it and one thing like that. But anyway, that was one problem easily fixed with a big screwdriver rammed through there for the race, with a screwdriver rammed through the filter in one of my bad moods. But the main problem was the diffuser. And once we went to the hot circuits and stuff, suddenly the rear instability came about. And you know, at the time, there's lots and lots of reasons for it, but at the time, I was pretty confident we had a problem with the diffuser and systems within the Ford relationship held us up from doing anything with it. But we ended up going to an airfield in England. We got a fairly decent camera to stick up the back of the diffuser because we couldn't detect any other way. Stick up the back of the diffuser, filled it full of wool tufts, and we had built an active rear suspension so we could drop the car down to the ground like high speed and then jack it up quickly like braking. And basically, the part of the diffuser where you stall it to get straight line speed, get the car low, the wool tufts would just drop, so there, it was turbulent and it was stalling. Jack the car up, and it would take almost 1.5 seconds before they would reattach. And that was, that's the braking zone into any corner. So the driver on the way into the corner had no rear stability whatsoever aerodynamically. So we actually went to Halford. Other shops are available to buy body filler. Made some little inserts for it that night at the airfield. Rubbed them down and made them all nice and tidy. Put the wool tufts on the next day, ran it again. Wool tufts would fall as normal, but the minute the car moved, it would reattach again. And we ran those padding inserts at the last two races of the year, and the car was suddenly a whole different deal.
Yeah, as quick as Sepang and Suzuka would have been, wasn't it?
Yeah, but it was a whole different deal, and obviously during that period in time, we had lost ourselves with the setup of the car, because whenever you got a problem like that, you always try to fix it somehow, botch it up with the setup, and you never get there. So suddenly just that fix, and the car was quick, and we never really got on top of the setup in two races. So annoyed about that, to be honest. And I told our MD at the time what I thought of him in America, and he didn't like it very much. So I got the sack. That's life.
So many of your stories end there. So many.
That's life.
But again, this is what the teams will all be doing. Maybe very powerful simulation tools, but some of them will have things they don't understand from what they've learned from the aero sweeps they've done, and they'll be trying to look for these little things that trip them up. So yeah, exactly the same thing. Well, one more day of testing to come tomorrow, so we'll have another podcast then to draw some conclusions from the first test, and then of course another week of testing, or 3 days of testing rather, next week. So please do subscribe to the podcast, give us a positive review if you liked it, and yeah, please keep listening.